ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down the road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and successes with all of us. And without any further ado, the man of the hour, the leader of the Studcast, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. How's it going today, Ron?
It's going great, Brian. Thank you very much, and I'm sure happy to be here. And looks like we're headed into another great Studcast here. And, you know, I'll just jump in real quick before we get too much said here. And I want to thank the fans, obviously. They make it happen for us. And for their tremendous support and all the compliments that came in on last week's Studcast, number 72, about the historic 1973 oil crisis and how you had stopped me from leaving the sport. And, I also want to thank the patrons, obviously. Got a lot of compliments, too, on the last hour of the Super Studcast number 11, the Bill Watts Super Studcast. And a lot of compliments there too, and just I really thank fans for that they're enjoying it, and I'm happy with that, and we're really just getting into the story. I mean, talking about a lifetime, my lifetime, my grandfather's, my father's, this is just now getting down to the really good part of my experiences in wrestling, and so I'm really really thrilled. And And today we're in, I can't believe it, number 73. And we're going to have a great one today. We're going to be all over the place.
Well, I got to tell you, Ron, we've touched on so many different topics, specifically the last several weeks. It seems that the further we go into your career, the more compelling your life becomes. You think that's fair?
Oh, yeah. I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, it does become pretty darn compelling. And as we roll into 74 here, it's just going to get wilder for me and better for me. And eventually in 44 and 74, I'm going to be starting my own company, the first of my four companies. And so it's a great experience for me, and I just really look forward to it. And if you don't mind, I think I'm just going to jump right into her, Brian. What we're going to do today is we're going to close out 1973 with the matches from the state of Florida, from the Georgia Territory, and from St. Louis. We're going to look ahead, obviously, to a little bit of 1974, hopefully. Depends on how long we take here, because we got a lot to discuss here today. It's been 1973 is a great year for me. 1974 is going to be best year so far. Yeah, things are going to just keep getting better and better. I'm going to wrestle only 11 times in the month of December of 1973. And when I look back at my chart of matches, I was really amazed by that. Only four matches in Florida for the entire month, four in St. Louis and three in Georgia. As we discussed in the last Studcast, they're not really using me a whole lot in Florida at this time because I'm spending all that time in St. Louis and I'm also spending time in Georgia during the Atlanta Wrestling War. So making me a little less valuable in Florida. So Louis Tillette, who's the booker at the time, he can't push me. It's not really his fault. He really can't push me a lot because I'm working so many nights in other territories. I'm not on their TV much because I'm not around on Wednesdays a lot of the time. And it's his job as a booker to draw money. So it's not really Louis' fault. It just happens to be what this case is.
You say now that it's not Louis' fault. At the time, though, in 1973, did you feel the same way or were you a little upset?
I was probably a little upset because I hadn't been in the business that long. I didn't understand how difficult it was for a booker because I had never done any booking at this point. So I really believed that, you know, he just doesn't appreciate what I can do or the talent I have. I mean, I shouldn't have questioned it because obviously if I'm getting used really great in St. Louis, it'd be ridiculous not to be used well in Florida. So, but I never blamed him for it. And I, as I explained a couple of times, maybe in the last program, Louis and I got along. He worked for me with Southeastern. He worked for me with Southeastern out of Pensacola. And, you know, we had great relationship when he was booking for me. So I do feel good about Louis. And I think he just was in a position where, as a booker, he's got to draw money every night. And if you got a guy that you're trying to use on top and he's not being seen on television and he's not working that much in your territory, if you're not on TV, fans say you're not there. And they look at TV every week and they want to see their stars every week. They don't see you. They think, what's gone? What's wrong with him? Where's he at? Is he hurt? They have a lot of questions. But that just seemed to be the case there at that time frame. And during this time frame, my cousin, Jimmy Golden, he's going to come to Florida for his first run there. And he's bigger and stronger, and he's much improved wrestler from the last time I saw him, which was a couple of years earlier. He gets over great in the Sunshine State. I mean, they love him. They always love Jimmy. Jimmy is a tremendous worker, always was. And before I get into today's program, I want to tell a quick story right off the top here about a little diving trip. He just comes down to Florida. I'm living in West Palm. Rob's living in Tampa. Rob's coming down and staying with me some every once in a while. And we're going to take a little diving trip down into the Keys. It's going to be me, my pregnant wife with the child. She's probably 6 months pregnant, 7 months pregnant at this point. Rob's going down with us, Jimmy and his girlfriend, and we're going to take a little diving trip out of Key Largo. And this is just after Jimmy arrives in the territory. Now, I'd been going down there for years. When I was in college at University of Miami, me and the guys used to go down and rent boats, and we'd go out on the reefs out there. And there's one of them out there that's about 6 miles out. It's a beautiful reef, probably one of the prettiest reefs in all of the Keys. Ken, the name escapes me right now of what the name it was, but I may come up with it before I finish this story. But anyway, we rent a boat and we go. You can't do this kind of stuff anymore. We go by this little dive center and we rent dive tanks. We rent the tanks and everything necessary to actually go diving. They don't even ask if we're qualified, if we've been qualified, if we took any training, which we hadn't. We'd never trained any before. This reef is probably only about 40 feet deep, most of the water. So it's not an extremely deep place to be diving and not probably as dangerous as it could have been. So, and we go out, all of us, everybody puts on tanks during that course of that, even my pregnant wife, which is really amazing. I had a hard time getting it on her. And so we're out there diving and enjoying the day. Beautiful day that day, really flat. One of those rare days out there when you get that far offshore that you're going to get flat surface. It looked like a mirror. And in fact, when you looked over the side, you could see the bottom at 40 feet deep easily. You could see the fish swimming around on the coral. And so we'd been up in the boat. We'd had a little bit of lunch. It's in the afternoon. We've probably been out there for 2 hours, maybe 3 hours. And we get back in the water to put our gear on again, and we're diving again. And I'm down there. We haven't seen any big fish all day long, not even barracuda, which there's a lot of barracuda on those reefs in the Keys. We hadn't even seen any big barracuda. And I'm down on the bottom, and I look up, and Rob's above me, and about 10 feet above Rob is probably a 12-foot hammerhead. I mean, he's a big boy, and he's just passing through the reef. He's got that head swaying back and forth like those hammerheads do, and they're ugly anyway. Got the big eyes out on the outsides of their head and strange-looking shark. And sometimes kind of dangerous, but not known to attack people. But it didn't take much during that time back in those days. I think this was prior to Jaws coming out. So people were not quite as scared of sharks as they got to be after that movie. But it was a little scary for me. I look up, I see him, and over his head is that hammerhead. Now, the hammerhead swims directly over him. Rob never sees him. And so I go to the surface, and by the time I get to the surface, up there on those reefs out there, they have these anchors. So you can anchor off the reefs. They don't let you anchor into the coral area, but off the reefs you anchor. And there's several boats around us, and some other people have already seen this hammerhead. So when I get to the surface, they're screaming, "Shark, shark!" You can hear it all across the reef, you know, and that's pretty common when that happens in the Keys, because people aren't used to seeing the big shark. So I tell everybody, you know, "Hey, get in the boat, get in the boat." And I get, and all day we've been getting in and out of this small boat that we've rented, and I have to get on the back of the boat and put my hand underneath people's rear ends and shove them up to get into the boat. They have a hard time getting in the boat. So this time I holler, "Shark," you know, let people know, "Hey, we want to get out of the water here. Don't take a chance." And as everybody comes up, they hear everybody screaming, "Shark," and everybody, I mean, Jimmy, his girlfriend, everybody who's had to be helped out of the water, they just go to the side of the boat, grab it, and just flip over inside the boat like they could have done all afternoon. But now that shark has given them a lot more incentive to get their big butts into the boat. And everybody fills up the boat. Everybody's scared as heck. The shark circles around the reef a little bit, and it's so clear and the water is so flat. You can see him every time he comes by the boat, comes underneath the boat. So it was a little bit of a terrifying experience. Jimmy, his first time diving. His girlfriend, his first time diving. Rob's, his first time diving. My wife's first time diving at that point. It's just, you know, I'm kind of out there, the only one that's done any diving at all, and kind of watching over everybody as best I could. But it was a great experience for Jimmy. He just gets to Florida. He gets out there on a reef. He gets to see a shark. It's like a great way to be introduced to Florida.
Who do you think threw a better drop kick, you or Jimmy?
Jimmy was great. Jimmy was a great worker. He threw a great drop kick. I don't know. I guess I'm a little bit prejudiced, you know, maybe. And because I'm taller than Jimmy. Jimmy is about 6'3", and I'm up there at 6'9". I feel like I was a little bit higher maybe on drop kicks because it's easier. I'm already higher than he is in the air. So, you know, but Jimmy was a tremendous, tremendous worker. And he just, everywhere he went, Jimmy got over. And he comes to Florida this time. He's still pretty young at this point. He's probably 23 years old, I gave. 22, 23 years old. But he's been in wrestling for a while. And he's really becoming a skilled guy in the ring. And they love him in the Sunshine State. He really gets over for a young guy. Doesn't take him long either to get it.
So Jimmy's in Florida, and you said you only worked 4 matches in the month of December. Who did you work against?
Well, I work the first one of these 4 matches is with Jimmy as a partner, and which that was great because I get an opportunity to see him do his thing. And we work against Don Carson and Les Thornton. I work another shot in West Palm during that month with Dick Slater. I work in Daytona Beach with an extremely talented Les Thornton. And I didn't know anything about Les Thornton until this match. And I finish up with Buddy Colt in West Palm toward the end of the month. And I thought I'd just break down these matches. Brian didn't take people into the inside of maybe a part of the sport that they really don't get to see, and how wrestlers talk about each other and how they think about each other. So, you know, there's a lot of tremendous talent across the country now, and I'm really experiencing it. St. Louis in particular, Atlanta is filling up with talent because the war's going on. The NWA is pumping that talent into Atlanta, too. And obviously, Florida's still got the great talent that they always have. So let me start with that tag match I had in West Palm with Jimmy against Don Carson and Les Thornton. And like I said, Jimmy just recently joined the crew in Florida, and it was great to see him in the ring, to see him actually work, and especially have the opportunity to be in a tag match with him. Now, Jimmy's been wrestling professionally longer than I have. He started probably 2 years before I did, because I'm still in college and didn't start until I got out of college. He starts at a much younger age, and he spent he's just a naturally great worker. Jimmy has phenomenal talent in the ring and a real good feel for the psychology of the sport. He knows when to make a move, when not to make a move, when to sell, when to make the comeback. He's really got that psychology part of the business down. And he spent a whole lot of his time in the sport working for his father, who was a promoter, along with the Fields brothers in Louisiana early in Jimmy's life and about the time Jimmy's getting started wrestling. And then later on, he's going to promote for Nick Gulas and Roy Welch out of Knoxville and Montgomery, Alabama. So Jimmy is going to start his career in Louisiana with Bill. That's his dad's name, Bill Golden. And he's going to become a great worker. He's going to be trained by some good guys, and he's going to really benefit from the fact that he's growing up in a wrestling family, and he's been able to see my dad wrestle and Roy wrestle, Herb, Lester, Jack, all of the guys that were in our early days. So and Don's in the ring. Don Carson is in the ring this match now, and Don's a great worker, but he's kind of lost in this match because Les Thornton just kind of steals the show. And he steals the show with his wrestling ability. Les is a tremendous wrestler, and he, being from England, that's not unusual. And it appears that what happens here during the course of this match, Les becomes the star on that heel side of the ring, and he's just wrestling, getting it done by doing some wrestling. And me and Jimmy, we got the ability to match Thornton on the wrestling side of it. So this tag, you know, after this match is over, I get to thinking that this tag is what Florida wrestling was all about back in those days. And it's exactly what I'm going to want to do when all four of us, the same four guys that's in this ring for this tag match in 73, are going to end up in my first territory in Southeastern wrestling down the road.
Les was not a big man, and I don't mean that as an insult. He was a junior heavyweight wrestler, and also he wasn't very tall. Were there any difficulties for you, being tall, wrestling against him?
Well, I'm going to discuss that in a few minutes. I want to talk about the match. I'm going to have a singles match with him, and I was going to talk about it in just a few minutes. So what I start doing, Brian, which is really funny, and I really can't figure out why I'm doing it, but there's something in me that I'm starting to assess talent. I'm starting to watch all matches and in every city I go to, and I have no idea in less than a year that there may be a reason for all this, that I'm going to own my own wrestling company. But it's something I guess I do because it comes naturally to someone like me that's come from a wrestling heritage. It's like I'm putting together a database of evaluations of every wrestler I see or work with. And I have no idea why at the time. I'm not thinking about being a promoter at the time, but I'm cataloging all this stuff in my head. And this process is going to be one of the things I do earlier in my career that I think helps me to be successful when I start Southeastern Championship Wrestling in 1974, in the fall of 74. So, well, let's just evaluate. You talked about Les Thornton and his size and everything. Let's just take Les Thornton as an example of what I'm doing by evaluating talent. I don't even realize, but I'm putting all these wrestlers in the back of my head as to which ones I'd like to have or which ones I would like to book or, you know, I'm thinking about the business from that side of it. Les Thornton was born in Manchester, England, 1934. He's, as you say, he's 5'9". He's not 6 feet tall. He weighs only 225 pounds. He started wrestling in 1957, and he retires in 1990. I thought he was one of the best junior heavyweights in the world. He wrestled in Great Britain. He wrestled in Japan. He wrestled in Europe. He wrestled all over North America. He held the WWF World Junior Heavyweight title and also the NWA Junior Heavyweight title 5 different times. At one point in his career, he held both titles at the same time. And that was rarely done because you had to be pushed by two companies at the same time in order to for them to put the strap on you. And holding them both at the same time occurred after the hostile takeover of Georgia Championship Wrestling by WWF. I think that's why he ended up with two belts at the same time, is because of that takeover of Georgia Championship Wrestling by WWF. He is a shorter guy. He's not big in size, but gosh almighty, he has that wrestling background that so many great guys from England seem to have.
Did you like the British style of wrestling?
I loved it. I absolutely loved the British style of wrestling, especially the junior heavyweights. So let's talk about the match that I have with Les Thornton in Daytona Beach that occurs in December of 73. And you can just imagine when he introduced us in the ring, I'm at 6'9", and he's a foot shorter than I am. You know, the people's reaction in the crowd is like, whoa, what the heck is this going to be? You know, it looks like that I'm just going to be able to just manhandle this guy. And that's not the case, because he's got a little shooting ability, and he just has that great ability and that knack for scientific wrestling like the English do. And so I love this style of work. He had lots of wrestling moves, and he was up and down really fast a lot. There's a lot of action in the match. If you're going to have, and we're going to have a scientific babyface match, he's not going to go out there and be a heel like normally. He's going to wrestle me, and we're going to really rock this building in Daytona, because then fans hadn't seen a lot of the stuff he's going to do, and they've not seen me do a lot of that stuff that I'm going to do, because I don't very often get to wrestle against an opponent that's as skilled as he is at wrestling. So I enjoyed working with the guys. I love to work with those guys that are fast and that move fast and use lots of reversals, that reverse the hammer locks and the wrist locks, and they work the legs. All of that is basic stuff, and it's so beautiful when it's done properly. It's really beautiful, and it's impressive to fans. The use of forearms. He did not throw punches. He used the forearm like Dory Funk Jr., as an example, was world champion. And when you do that, it provides the fans a true scientific match, because even though he's hitting you with forearms, he's really not hitting you with punches. And it enables to tear the house down. When you know, even when a brawling type of match won't get over, this match gets over. It's one of those matches in which I'm sure when we left the ring that the guys that watch it said, damn, how are we going to follow that? Because we gave them what was on the marquee out front. They came to see wrestling, and we gave them 30 minutes of real wrestling. Really, I think it was it left us both with a lot of respect for each other, I think, when we left the ring. And I cataloged Les Thornton in my memory right then that night, and that he's a great wrestler. He has all this tremendous skills. And a few years later, he's going to come and work for me. And he's going to work with another fantastic junior heavyweight from England that comes to work for me in Southeastern, named Tony Charles. And Tony Charles, I fell in love with Tony Charles. He fell in love with me and my family. And Tony is going to never, this is about 1975, Tony's going to arrive in Knoxville, and he's never going to work for anybody else the rest of his career other than my family. And I thought that was a great testament to Tony and And gosh, I would have kept him forever. If he'd have wanted to wrestle forever, he's one of those type of guys that you just never let him go. Why would you ever let a guy that's that talented and that good, great personality, fans just loved him. Now, Thornton's a heel, Tony's a babyface, but I booked him. I love to book those two together. And whenever I booked them together, I made a point of going out and watching the match because they were wonderful matches, just absolutely phenomenal matches. And that combination was going to be perfect for changing the style and the believability of matches when I start Southeastern. When I get started there, you know, there's a bunch of fans there that have just seen a lot of fighting and chiseling and things like that that the Wrights do. But they've never had a real taste of real wrestling. And they watch these matches with Tony Charles and Les Thornton, and they just go home talking about that match more than anything else. And it's perfect. That's a perfect education, I thought, for those current fans that had been there for many, many years. But I was really hoping to attract the thousands of new fans out there that had not been able to watch the Ron Wrights type of match and those type of matches. And when they started coming, I was throwing them a lot of Tony Charles and Les Thornton. And I knew that it was going to do what it did in Florida that created such a great territory there. It's going to create wrestling fans who love wrestling. And that was my intention. Every time I could get Les into my territory, I brought him in. I always put him with Tony. They used to do one spot. I don't know if you've ever seen this, Brian. It was one of the most beautiful little spots that Tony Charles would end up on his back on the mat, and the guy would be on top of him. He would have Tony's hands pinned to the mat. Tony would bridge up on his shoulders to. And the referee would start to count. He would have to pull his shoulders up. The guy would go up in the air and come down and slam on Tony's midsection with his rear end to try to break him out of his bridge. He was bridging up to keep from being counted out. The guy would do that to him a couple of times less, and Tony did this magnificently. Les would go fly up in the air with his legs, come down and try to drive Tony back flat on the mat. Tony would go down. He would come right back up. About the second time he would go up, Tony would catch him as he threw his body up straight up in the air. Tony would take his legs and catch him right around the hips with his legs. And then when Les came down, Tony would come up off the mat and they would go back into the ropes, and Tony would be up way over the top of the ropes. Beautiful, really a lot of height. And then he would flip him from there. When he went back to the mat, he would take those legs and shoot him in the air, and Les would take this big dramatic bump on the far side of the ring. It was absolutely beautiful. I never saw them do that in which the fans just did not go crazy. It was really amazing.
You had Les and Tony and later on Adrian Street that worked for you. Are there any common traits that you noticed in all the British wrestlers?
They could wrestle. That was really the common thread with all British wrestlers, I thought. And it wasn't just them. It was a lot of different people from England. If you had that English background, sometimes they weren't really great at getting heat. They weren't really great at having an American style match sometimes, but by golly, when you put those two Englishmen together, it didn't make any difference what the combination was. They managed to go out there and really, really tear the house down and leave those fans going home, like I said, talking about wrestling. So Les Thornton, he's in the back of my brain at this point. I haven't even heard of Tony Charles at this point, never met Tony Charles at this point. He's about to show up in Florida, and I'm going to get my first taste of Tony. But I'm cataloging these guys, all this talent that I'm seeing in all these places, St. Louis, Georgia, and then Florida. And I'm going to start, once I get my company going, I'm going to handpick my guys to begin with. I want to fill my territory with guys that have a wrestling background and that we can make wrestling as popular as the old style of the Ron Wrights with the chisel and all the blood and all the fighting. we're going to give them a whole lot of wrestling that they've never seen in East Tennessee.
Who else did you work with in Florida in the month of December?
I think I end up in Florida with Buddy Colt. It's a West Palm match again. It's on December 27, 1973. It's another great match. I always had a great match with Buddy Colt. Anybody could have a great match with Buddy Colt. He's an absolutely fabulous worker. And that happens to be the last match of 1973 for me, December 27 of 1973. So, you know, let's roll into St. Louis a little bit. You know, and we're still doing the Florida. We're doing the St. Louis. So in December 73, I have my first television match in December 73 with Hans Schmidt. We're back to the same Hans Schmidt, and we have talked extensively about it, about this opponent. It was about a tough 20-minute plus match. I end up beating him. Although the next day I feel like I probably lost the match because I'm sore as hell from being beat all to hell. And, you know, it's tough to work with Hans Schmidt. I'll probably put Hans Schmidt in my top five all-time worst guys to work with. I never liked working with him, and I wasn't the only one. I was a lot of guys in the dressing room. When the booker would come around, and sometimes you forget or you don't remember who you're wrestling that night, you don't know yet, and he would say to you, "You've got Hans Schmidt." I used to like to watch the faces. Because guys were like, "Oh, no, no, no." So Hans had a lot of respect or disrespect. I ain't sure exactly how to put it, but you did not want to end up in the ring with him. I had a return match with Blackjack Lanza in Kiel Auditorium, and it's kind of the one I talked about a couple of episodes ago in Studcast number 71, in which I talked Pat O'Connor into working a little angle and making a handicap match. And because Lanza says, "Hey, look, that young punk ain't ready for me, and he needs a partner if he's got any chance of beating me." We go into Kiel Auditorium. I end up not tagging the partner at all and beating him without touching the partner. And so he comes back and asks for a tougher match. And we have a no DQ. We come back and have a no DQ. There is no winner. And we'll be coming back again early in January to wrestle in what's very, very unusual for Sam to do this in St. Louis. But we come back to wrestle in a death match. One of the first ones I saw anytime I was in St. Louis, one of the rare death matches I ever saw in St. Louis. And in that death match, he's going to put me over, and I'm coming back then against 2 weeks after that against Harley Race for a world championship match. So I worked two more TVs in December. I worked with Angus Campbell against Bill Miller and Hans Schmidt again, and a single with Baron Mikhail Cicluna, and I win both of those too.
Talk to me a little bit about Cicluna. What was that like to work with him? He was a Northeast staple.
Cicluna was a pretty darn good worker. And, you know, Cicluna, wrestling is really crazy back in those days about where guys come from. Cicluna is not from the United States. He's born in a town called, in 1929, he's born in a town called Balzan. It's on the Isle of Malta. He's 6 feet three and 256 pounds. Now, he's a big boy. He worked a lot in Canada until coming to the WWWF in 65. And when he gets to the WWWF, he's going to win the World United States Tag Team Championships with Smasher Sloan in 1966. And then in 1972, he's going to win the world tag title in WWWF with King Curtis Iaika, another name we've talked about quite a bit. In 1976, he's actually going to become a part of wrestling history when he's sent over the top rope in a television match against Gorilla Monsoon, and he's going to leave the studio. And Muhammad Ali is sitting on the first row for this television match. And once Cicluna leaves the ring, Ali and gets counted out. And they ring the bell and raise his hand. Ali's going to jump in the ring to try to fight with Gorilla Monsoon. Crazy. He takes a couple jabs at him, and Monsoon snatches Ali up and gives him an airplane spin. And this is an angle that's being worked to build up for Ali's infamous boxing and wrestler match with Antonio Inoki. It's going to happen later in that month in Japan. So, you know, crazy that they work a television angle and with WWF that's going to lead up to Inoki and Ali in that crazy match in Japan they had.
That match was for years considered awful, but now it's considered the birth of MMA by many.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, you know, that's what it was. It appeared to be a shoot, and it was probably close to a shoot. Obviously, Inoki was a great wrestler. And he had shooting ability. Obviously, Ali was a great fighter, and he could fight, and he knew how to punch. And, you know, they didn't want to hurt each other, and obviously they booked this. How it got started, where the idea came from, I don't know. But it really made a star out of Inoki, and I think it had a lot to do with what's about to happen when they split off. The great friendship between Inoki and Baba burst, and they both start running against each other. All part of history in Japan, which is an amazing history in itself. So look, Sakluna, he retires in 1983, and he's inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 1996. He died in 2010, pancreatic cancer, I believe it was. And he gets I'm getting a win against Sakluna on TV. Jesus, that's, you know, he's a very famous opponent. Baron Sakluna is a big name, and it's a real testament to my growth as a wrestler and how they feel about me in St. Louis to put me over against a guy like that. I'm really going places in St. Louis, and it's amazing to get a win like that over a guy like Baron Sakluna.
We will return in just a moment with Ron's Georgia matches from December of 1973. But first, a few words about the Super Studcast and the Stud Store.
Ron Studcast and Super Studcast have been on fire lately. Super Studcast number 11 with Cowboy Bill Watts has set records again and is still available along with 10 other fantastic 3-hour Super Studcast at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. We're happy to announce the next Super Studcast number 12 will be released on Tuesday, December 11th, and will feature the incomparable cousins Tommy Wildfire Rich and Johnny Crack. Ash Rich. These two great stars will be discussing the upcoming release of the Continental and Southeastern Wrestling TV shows from the Lost Territory series of the 1980s at tnstud.com and patreon.com/studcast. And don't forget to visit the Stud Store at tnstud.com to select great gifts for all your friends and relatives, like the unique Studcast t-shirts and personally autographed photos from the stud himself. Hurry with your orders now so you can get everything you want before Christmas. Hey everybody, it's David Summers wishing you and your family the best Christmas ever from all of us at Studcast Central in the Great Smoky Mountains. Merry Christmas.
There you hear it once again, the Super Studcast, the next one, Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy and Johnny Rich coming at you on December 11th. More information about that at the end of the program, but Ron, we've talked about it. Let's get to Georgia. What were you up to in the Peach State in December of 1973?
Well, you know, we've talked about a whole lot of this, some of it during, we've talked about the Atlanta Wrestling War. It's part of this. I'm going to be back there getting ready to wrestle Bill Watts for the Georgia Heavyweight Championship. Although I've been there once in the year before, just prior to Christmas time. And that's the time I was basically sent there to see if I could talk Ann Gunkel out of stopping with her plans to run opposition in Georgia. And I wasn't able to do that, but I'm going back again on December 14th, 1973. It's almost a year later since I have been to Atlanta, and they're going to put me in the ring with Hiro Matsuda at the old Atlanta City Auditorium. And the Atlanta Wrestling War is still going on. But at this point in the wrestling war in 73, Lester Welch and Bill Watts, they've started to take control of the battle for Georgia. They're drawing money and they're doing pretty darn good business now. Things have changed dramatically, and this is normally a bad month for wrestling, December. But that's not the case this December in Atlanta. And Georgia itself, the entire state's wrestling is really on fire. That's unusual, too. You've got two different wrestling companies in the same territorial area, and both of them are doing pretty decently. At this point, obviously, Lester's organization is going to is taking control, and they're obviously going to win the war at some point here. But Gunkel is still doing well and is still drawing some crowds. So Matsuda go out there, and we have a partial shoot match. You know, it kind of reminded me that we were back in the snake pit. You know, it was, you know, Matsuda was that type of worker. He liked to go for you, and he was such a fabulous wrestler. And it was just a thrill and an honor to work with a guy like that. I had had very few actual matches with Hiro. But we have a great one there, and and we're getting over, you know, if they're putting me over. He just puts me over right in the middle, man. Makes me look great because I'm going to come back in 2 weeks and wrestle Cowboy Bill Watts for the Georgia Heavyweight Championship. Actually, it's 1 week later. So I come in there, wrestle Matsuda. They set me up, put me over. I'm going back to wrestle Watts. And the Matsuda match makes a statement, along with the extensive angle between Watts and my brother Roberts going on. And it sets us up perfectly for another sellout in December, prior to Christmas. Unheard of. So they've got it rocking there in Georgia. And it's a beautiful place to be because, you know, I'm going to get a nice payoff. I'm going to have opportunity to wrestle an old friend that I dealt with in the snake pit for many, many years, and somebody I admire and respect greatly.
By this point in 73, things had started to change. Of course, Bill Watts was in there as not just a booker, but as an owner, part owner of the office. And at the end of 73, he's getting ready to move to Florida. Jim Barnett comes back in October of 73. So everything's set up here. You know, Watts had done a great job. Him and Lester got into the Omni, ran the first three Omni shows, built up wrestling too. A lot of important things happened in 73 to set things up for the future of Georgia Championship Wrestling. How well did you know Bill Watts at this time?
I did not know Bill Watts. I had never met Bill Watts. That's how well I knew him. I didn't know anything about Bill Watts. I'm on the road in St. Louis a lot. I'm in Florida being taken care of and being used on top. And I just, our trails had never crossed. And Watts, this is crazy, Watts doesn't want to put wrestling two over. And that's the only reason I'm there. Watts is going to go to Florida and he's going to become a booker. He can't remain the Georgia heavyweight champion and do the company in Georgia any good business. So obviously he's got to drop the title, and they wanted him to drop it on two. And he picks me for, I have no reason. I have no idea why Bill Watts picks me to come out of Florida and do this switch for them. It's a nice thing for me. It's a great opportunity. It gives me I win the Georgia Heavyweight Championship right there at the end of 1973. I've had a phenomenal championship year. I start out early in the year winning the Southern Heavyweight Championship. Rob and I are the Florida Tag Team Champions in the summer, and I'm going to end up being the Georgia Heavyweight Champion before Christmas. So it's kind of a nice Christmas present for me. And when I get there after that Hiro match, I stay. I don't go home on Saturday. I stay over and I wrestle in a small town about 40 miles outside Atlanta called Griffin, Georgia. And it happened to be the city where I was a basketball player for my junior year in high school. A pretty popular basketball player and pretty well recruited, and there was a lot of publicity. And so when I go back there to wrestle in Griffin, I'm 3 inches taller than I was when I was a junior in high school, and I'm 100 pounds heavier. And in the last 8 years, I've gained 3 inches in height and 100 pounds in weight. and a pretty significantly different person than what I was back in those days. I work a six-man tag that night with my brother Rob and a great friend of mine, Les Thatcher, who is I spent a lot of time with when I first went to Florida. He left probably in 72. I hadn't even seen him, I don't think, since 72. And I show up, and he's my partner in the ring that night. And we're in a six-man tag. We work with Bobby Shane, Crazy Luke Graham, and Gorgeous George Jr. before a sold-out crowd in the arena that my dad built in 1970 in that town. Dad wanted to have a regular Saturday night town for the Georgia territory because they were running these spot shows. They didn't have a big Saturday night city to run in. And he says, let's build this building in this small town, but let's put the best card in there that we can. And because they own the building, they're going to get the concessions. They're going to benefit in so many different ways. They don't pay any rent. It's a fabulous idea to build a building in this city. And that building's going to hold about 2,000 people. It's made for wrestling, but they're going to have all kinds of events in there. They're going to have concerts. They're going to have lots of different other events in there. So it's a fabulous idea that Dad comes up with. We sell out his building that night. We're still, prior to Christmas, unheard of to be going to these small towns and filling the building just right before Christmas. It was kind of a homecoming for me, and there were several players from my former basketball team that came to see me wrestle, came and see me in the dressing room. I went out and talked to them, and I realized, just how far I've come in the last 8 years. Pretty amazing to me.
In a place like Griffin, Georgia, or maybe even Miami, where you went to school, did anyone ever show up at the matches and say, wait a minute, that's Ron Welch. What's this Fuller business?
Yeah, they knew me. Those guys came to me and they knew me. They had seen it, talked about the match, talked about on television. I don't think there probably was an interview, but they probably showed the card for Griffin tonight and they saw my name there. If they were, and a lot of those people, I had them follow me from Griffin and my junior year. And then when I went to Atlanta to live in Atlanta my senior year and played for Briarcliff, those guys came to the matches to watch me. In fact, the Briarcliff group comes when I wrestle in Atlanta to against Mr. Wrestling 2 weeks after that I win from Bill Watts. There, I'm going to get a different school that I've competed in and guys that I've played with that's going to come to me, and they're just going to be blown away by who I am. All of a sudden, I'm not just Ron Welch. I'm a wrestler. I'm big time. I'm Ron Fuller. I'm wrestling for the champion. I am the champion. The night they come to Atlanta, I am the champion, about to wrestle Wrestling too and defend the title. So it's a great thing. And for those guys, I see a lot of those guys stay kind of in contact with me for many, many years. And sometimes they just show up in some place out of nowhere, and there's a guy that I played ball with in high school. Kind of strange, but it's a nice deal.
Let's get to the Watts match, because you've talked about it, and I actually want to hear your memories of that night.
Okay, yeah. So we go back on this Friday night. It's right before Christmas. I fly back into Atlanta, and I'm going to face the Big Cowboy for the championship. And the special referee, Haystacks Calhoun. Well, there's not much messing around you're going to do with Haystacks Calhoun in the ring. So I figure I got a great opportunity. And this match is really a super match. We have a great match considering we've never met each other and we've never obviously worked with each other. And we go out there and really have a fantastic match. And obviously, like I said, Watts is leaving Georgia to take over the book. And he won't put the strap on Wrestling too. And I'm brought in for it. And so that's the plan. And Watts comes to me early in the night and he says, do you have any spots in mind? Do you have anything you'd like to do? And so we've already discussed some of this in past Studscasts, but obviously we're going to switch the belt, and I'm going to put it back on who is going to be one of the hottest wrestlers in the history of Georgia wrestling, Mr. Wrestling 2. and can't hardly wait to get involved and get to that match.
You brought up some of the political issues in the sense that Bill Watts refused to drop the belt to Wrestling 2. It had to go to you and then from you to Wrestling 2. How often does something like this happen concerning the switching of a title? Are there occurrences where it becomes a problem politically to do the title change the way you want? And is there anything particular about this match that you remember?
Well, the switching of the title, that's pretty unusual and it's significant. You don't really hear of many guys when they make a champion out of you and they decide to make a change. You don't get many guys that say, no, I don't want to do it, or I don't like who you want me to do it for. This is the first time I've ever heard of this situation in my career when this happens, and I don't know that I've ever heard of it since. You know, it's pretty unusual for that to happen, and you know, it can really give you a bad reputation. And you know, Bill's kind of reputation at this point anyway, and when he decides, no, I don't want to put it on that guy, and he starts calling those kind of shots, that's beyond his ability to do or where he should be as a booker. He's not thinking about his territory then. He's thinking about himself. It appears to be that way. And that could hurt you in the future. So I think that's why you don't see that happen very often, because guys realize that you know, I'm here and I've got the championship belt because they want me to have it and they gave it to me. And when they get ready to take it away from me, I've got to be man enough to say, okay, I'll do what you want. So it didn't happen in this case. But this particular match, I do remember something, but in this match, I do remember something that really, and I think this is what makes Watts fall in love with me in a way, is Bill comes to me before the match, and we introduce ourselves, and we talk a little bit, and then we talk a little bit about the match, and he tells me what we're going to do, but he says, you know, Ron, can you think of something that we could do right before we get into the finish that can really pop the crowd? Something that's spectacular. And then he leaves me to think about, you know, what the hell I'm going to do and what kind of spot we can come up with. So when he comes back to me, we talk again before we go to the ring, and he says, you know, have you come up with anything? And I tell him, yeah, you know, and what I decide that we would be good, you know, and I don't know, he's never seen this done, probably, because I'd never done it at this point. I didn't know whether I could do it or not, but I thought about this being a great spot. So what we did is he builds up his heat, and I think he gives me a stampede. The end of the heat, he's going to count me out, and I kick out of his big move, which is, you know, great spot right there. You know, the people were amazed. You know, they'd never seen anybody kick out of his Oklahoma Stampede. So, and then I get to where I'm making a little comeback on him, and by in the middle of the comeback, he blinds me, takes a headlock, and I shoot him in the ropes, and he hits me with a tackle. I go down. He comes for another tackle. I drop down. He goes across me. As he comes back for me again, I leapfrog over him. And then the third time he comes through, I pick him up for a scoop slam. But I lose my balance, or I make it look like I lose my balance. I stagger quickly backwards against the rope, and both of us go over that top rope together upside down. Wow, what a monster pop. I don't think anybody had ever seen that before in Atlanta. Two guys go over backwards upside down. I drop him on purpose on the apron of the ring, and I hit on my feet on the concrete, but I continue to fall face first and smack my head on the apron of the ring and then go down to the concrete. When I tell Watts about this spot, he's like, wow, Ron, wait a minute. Whoa. He's concerned. You know, he goes, have you ever done this before? And I go, no, but I know I can do it. And so the spot goes perfectly for him, you know, and it doesn't hurt him. And then we get the big pop, and, you know, and then as a matter of fact, I'm going to use a spot in these photos. I put these photos on my website. Where for the studcast photo, and I put a photo in the gallery that is usually the same photo. And this week I'm going to use a picture of Bill Watts as a young guy stampeding somebody so that fans get to see this move that he puts on me right before we go into this other move. We get back into the ring, obviously, and I end up taking the belt. So, you know, bottom line is I win the Georgia Heavyweight Championship on the next to the last match that I have in 1973. I become the Georgia Heavyweight Champion.
How did you come up with that idea for that spot?
I don't know. I knew that I'm tall, and most of the ring ropes, now ring ropes, rings are all made differently, but most ring ropes are just about, above the middle of my back. And I knew that because I could back up into the ropes and it would be just, I'd say the lower part of my back, that top rope would catch the lower part of my back, and that he's in my arms, that all I've got to do is just basically hold on to him and let his weight flip me over that rope, and I'll go down to the floor and I'll drop him on the apron. That's what he's most concerned about. Where am I going to fall, Ron, on the concrete? I said, no, I'm going to drop you on the apron. I'm going to fall on the concrete. So, you know, he liked it. And I think that had some bearing. When he comes in 74 to take over the book in Florida, I think he's going to use me very, very well. I think a lot had to do with this particular match.
And we look forward to getting into that on future Studcasts. But Ron, as we get close to the end of the show here, it's been a while since we've had some listener questions here on the show. Let's get a couple in here before we wrap things up. This first one is from Joseph Darwin in Boston, Massachusetts. This is a hot-button issue. I hope this doesn't start any problems here. How did both your brother Robert and you become the Tennessee Stud? Which one of you was the original Tennessee Stud?
This is a great question. I get this all the time. No, I see this. I see this, and I'm asked this all the time. And I guess we might as well cover it a little bit here. I was the original Tennessee Stud. When I went to Knoxville and I bought that business, I wanted to turn heel and I needed something to really get some heat for me. And I felt like by using that sound, that song, and by using some of the lyrics and just changing the words a little bit so that it fit me and who and my personality, that it was going to get a lot of heat. I stayed the Stud until I retire in 1988, and when I retire in 1988, Rob is still working, and Jimmy. Rob and Jimmy are working tag teams in a lot of territories. They're going to work in Smoky Mountain Wrestling for Jim Cornette. They're going to work in Texas for the Von Erichs. And so Rob wanted to came and asked me. He said, "Well, you know, you're going in hockey, and you know, you're not going to wrestle anymore. Can I be the Tennessee Stud?" And, you know, and I had robes. I had all the stuff. I said, "Yeah, man, I don't have a problem with that." And he says, "Well, can I use your robes?" And I said, "Sure. Yeah, go ahead, man. You can be the Stud. I don't care." And so that was pretty good. It worked very well for years and years. And then later on, when we got around the year 2000, I decided to come back and do a little promoting again. And I want to use the name. And since that time, probably the year 2000 or so, Rob and I have had this continual little argument about who is the real Tennessee Stud. And I got no question in my mind. If he was here, he'd say I got none in mine either, I'm sure. So, but it's been a contentious matter probably since at least 2000. But it's a great question. Super question, and one I get quite a bit.
I think the only way to get the real answer is to ask Jimmy Golden. But before we get there, Ron, who came up with the name Stud Stable?
I did. And I started doing that. Bob Armstrong and I, we'd had that world championship match in which he turned on me and the Ric Flair match and put me out of wrestling for a while. I came back and I was a babyface in that match. Bob turned heel in that match for the first time in his life, in his career. He became a heel that night and just was fantastic with it. I came back as a babyface. Bob goes ahead and stays heel for a little bit longer, then turns babyface. And once I get him back as a babyface, I go back to that same old heel I was way back in the early part of coming to Southeastern Wrestling in Pensacola. And I turn on Bob again. Then I go form my stud stable. And the whole reason, concept for it was that I didn't want to wrestle against Bob. So I started putting together these heel wrestlers for me and putting them in the ring against Bob all the time. And I was the man out there. And that's when I got the tuxedo and the top hat and the cane. And I thought that was probably some of the best heat I ever had in wrestling was during the stud stable time when I got Arn Anderson and Jerry Stubbs and, oh gosh, Jimmy Golden. I had a fabulous group of heels, humongous, wow, great group of heels. And I really, really, really had some heat with that stud stable.
Let's get one more question in here, Ron. This one is from John Hanley. No hometown listed, so parts unknown, I will assume. You guys did a lot of driving back in the day. What kind of cars did the guys drive? And do you have any funny memories of somebody's car?
Well, that's a different type of question, isn't it? Guys drove big cars. Most wrestlers drove big cars because you were going to take somebody with you and you had other big wrestlers and they needed that area, that room area. The memory I have of a car is the best memory I have of a car is not a car. It was a van. And that van was owned by Joe LaDuke, and he's wrestling for me in Knoxville. He's a babyface at that time, and he called his van the Starship, and he used to load it up with wrestlers, and guys wanted to ride with Joe because Joe's such a great guy, great personality, always upbeat, always having a good time. And we would take the old Starship and make these trips, short trips, because we didn't have long trips to make, but always have a ball. Guys had a great time. And I'd say Joe LaDuke's old Starship van was probably the most memorable vehicle I ever rode in. And Joe was a big guy that he liked music. And I turned him on to some music in there. He didn't know anything about the song Free Bird. Free Bird was out then. I turned him on to Free Bird, and I turned him on to Do You Feel, a song by, gosh, Peter Frampton. And Joe played that sucker every time I was in his van, going or coming, sometimes going and coming. He would play those two songs because he had never heard them before, and it just became favorite for him. I love Joe LaDuke. He was a fantastic person and a great guy. And a lot of people, I wasn't the only one in wrestling that really had great feelings for Joe LaDuke. He was a unusually wonderful person.
Did you turn on anyone else to get any good records?
I had other guys that would turn me on to records. I was not a guy that listened to a lot of music, but I'd love those two songs. And somehow Joe and I got to talking about it. The guy that turned me on to a lot of records was Ken Lucas.
Really?
Ken Lucas was he was into it. And Ken Lucas was the most knowledgeable guy I was ever around with music. And he would tell me, he worked for me in Pensacola in the early 80s. And he told me there were groups that were coming out, Genesis, and he was saying, this guy, Ron, you got to listen to this guy, and you got to listen to that guy. And then sometimes he would get me to ride with him. He had a van, and he would play the music for me. I mean, it was like a concert going and coming. And I really loved him. There's another guy that had great respect and very admired in wrestling and was a wonderful person, Ken Lucas.
How many guys had vans?
Oh, gosh, a lot of guys. Now, back in the early 80s, once we got into Pensacola, Joe was about the only one that had the van in the early days of Southeastern out of Knoxville. But once we went to Pensacola, everybody was getting vans. I ended up getting three different vans over a three-year period of time. Rob had a van. Jimmy had a van. Half the crew had vans. It was the way to travel in the 80s. And you had those old captain seats, the four big seats and the couch in the back and the music and the TVs. And you were beginning to get all that stuff incorporated inside the vehicle. It was the way to travel. And it was just a time frame. It was wonderful. Those early 80s were just fantastic. to be a wrestler.
Well, as we wrap things up, Ron, we want to remind the listeners that you can automatically become friends with Ron on Facebook. All you have to do is like his page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow Ron on Instagram and Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter, at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. We want to remind you once again to visit the Tennessee Studs website, tnstud.com. You get access to both the regular Studcast every single episode, as well as 3 hours that are additional content, the Super Studcast, the rest of the story, and you also have the Tennessee Stud store, pictures, videos, and so much more. You can get a Studcast t-shirt and autograph photo right now in time for Christmas. Once again, tnstud.com. for all your Tennessee Stud needs. We also want to remind you once again to go to tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast, only $2.99, and you get to join and check out the 11 great Super Studcasts, including Jim Cornette, Cowboy Bill Watts, Kevin Sullivan, the Honky Tonk Man, Stan Hansen, Terry Funk, and much, much more. And get ready, Tuesday, December 11th, Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy Wildfire Rich and Johnny Crash Rich. Check that out once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, real quickly here, I'm going to take that Joseph Darwin, I believe is his name, that first question we had today, I'll make him the winner today, okay? And then we're going to go, we're in here in 1974. It's going to be a phenomenal year in my life. And we're going to, early on here, we're going to be going to Atlanta and giving up the Georgia Heavyweight Championship. 7 days later, I'm going to be wrestling for the world title against Harley Race in St. Louis. We're going to get into my winning the Florida Heavyweight Championship. We're going to be in that Dusty Rhodes explosion that happens in Florida in 1974. So much more coming ahead. It's just amazing. And I'm really happy that we're going to be entering this time frame, because it is just phenomenal so far as what happens in my life.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.